Our acceptance is that nations work together, or operate against one another functionally, or as guided by the murderous supervisions of a whole organism. Or, apologizing again, I call such organized slaughter, supermetabolism. So enormous is the subject of human history, as affected by its partness in a whole, that I shall reserve it for treatment some other time. Monistically, though some other time, I shall pluralistically take another view, as well the acceptance is that human beings have not existed as individuals any more than have cells in an animal organism existences of their own. Still, one must consider that there is something of individuality, or contrariness in every cell. This view of submergence is now so widespread that it is expressed by writers in many fields of thought. But they lack the concept of a whole, trying to think of a social organism as a whole, though clearly every social quasi-organism has relations with other social quasi-organisms, and is dependent enormously, or vitally, upon environment. Other thinkers, or more than doubtful thinkers, say that they think of the unthinkable absolute as the whole. I have a notion that, for ages, as a factor in an automatic plan, the Australian part of our existence's nucleus, this Earth, was reserved. If this be not easy to think, it is equally hard to think why Australia, in its fertile parts, was not colonized by Asiatics. There was relative isolation. But it was not geographical isolation. The distance between Cape York, Australia, and New Guinea is only 100 miles. There was an approximation to isolation so extreme that one type of animal life grew up and prevailed. This gap was jumped by the marsupials of Australia. Then the question is why, if not obediently to an inhibition, was it not jumped the other way? Of course we can have no absolute expressions, but just when the dingoes and the wild cattle of Queensland first arrived in Australia is still considered debatable. There were civilizations in the Americas, but they were civilizations that could not resist the relatively late appearing Europeans. Long before, there had been other civilizations in Central America, but they had disappeared, or they had been removed. The extinction of them is, by archaeologists, considered as mysterious, as is the extinction of the dinosaurs, by the paleontologists, or as, by cells of a later period, might be considered the designed and scheduled, or purposeful, extinction of cartilage cells in an embryo. The expression is that Australia and the Americas were reserved, as relative blanks, in which human life upon this earth could shake off, after a fashion, many conventions and traditional hamperings, and start somewhat anew. Drones appear in a beehive. They are reserved. At first they contribute nothing to the welfare of the hive, but there is a providence that looks after them just so long as they will be of future use. This is automatic foresight and purpose, according to automatic plan, in a beehive, regarded as a whole. The god of the bees is the hive. There is no necessity to think of an external control, nor of any being, presiding over the bees and directing their affairs. Reservations besides those in the affairs of bees and men are common. Some trees have buds that are not permitted to develop. These are known as dormants, and are held in reserve, against the possibility of a destruction of the tree's developed leaves. In one way or another, there are reservations in every organism. We think of intermundane isolations that have been maintained, as once the Americas were kept separated from Europe, not by vast and untraversable distances, but by belief in vast and untraversable distances. I have no sense of loneliness in thinking that the inorganic sciences that are, by inertia, holding out for the isolation of this earth, have lost much power over minds. There are dissatisfactions and contempts everywhere. There may be civilizations in the lands of the stars, or it may be that, in the concavity of a starry shell, vast, habitable regions have been held in reserve for colonization from this earth. Though there is considerable opposition to wars, they are, as at any moving picture place, one can see, still popular, but other eliminations of human beings have waned, and it is likely that for a long time birth control will have no more than its present control upon births. The pestilences that used to remove millions are no longer so much heard of. It may be that an organic existence is, by lessening eliminations, preparing a pressure of populations upon this earth that can have relief only in enormous colonizing outlets somewhere else. It is as if concordantly, the United States has shut down, as a relief, to superabundances of people in Europe, and as if representing the same purpose or plan, Australia and Canada, as well as the United States, are shutting out Asiatics. It is as if cooperatively with the simultaneous variations of need, aviation is developing, as the means of migratory reliefs. If there be a nearby land that is a revolving shell of stars. And if, according to data that I have collected, there be not increasing coldness and attenuation of air, past a zone not far from this earth. 1930-something or another, maybe 1940 or 50. There's a flash in the sky. It is said to be a meteor. There's a glow. That is said to be an aurora borealis. The time has come. The slogan comes. Skyward ho! The treks to the stars. Flows of adventurers and the movietone news press agents and interviews and somebody about to sail to Lyra reduces expenses by letting it be known what brand of cigarettes he'll take along. Caravels with wings and the covered planes of the sky and writers of complaints to the newspapers, this dumping of milk bottles and worse from the expeditions is an outrage. New comets are watched from this earth, long trains of voyagers to the stars, when at night they turn on their lights. New constellations appear, the cities of the lands of the stars. And then the commonplaceness of it all. Personally conducted tours to Taurus and Orion. Summer vacations on the brink of Vega. My father tells of times, when people, before going to the moon, made their wills. Just the same, there was something peaceful about those old skies. It's getting on my nerves, looking up at all those lipstick and soap and bathing suit signs. Or my own acceptance that there can be no understanding of our existence, if be overlooked the irony of it all. The aristocratic astronomers, their alleged rapport with infinitude, their reputed familiarity with the ultra-remote, the academic, the classical. One looks up and sees, instead, an illuminated representation of a can of spaghetti in tomato sauce, in the sky. The commonplaceness of it all. Of course the stars are near. Who, but a few old fossils, ever thought otherwise? Does the writer of this book think that he found out anything new? All these notions of his were matters of common knowledge, away back in the times of ancient Greece. 22. That, in the summer of 1880, some other world, or whatever we'll call it, after a period of hard luck, cheered up and cast off its despairs which came to this earth, where there is always room for still more melancholy in long, black, funereal processions. August 18, 1880 people, near the waterfront of Havre, France, saw the arrival of a gloom. Sails, in the harbor of Havre, suddenly turned black. But, like every other gloom, this one alternated with alleviations. The sails flapped white. There was a flutter of black and white. Then enormous numbers of the units of these emotions were falling into the streets of Havre. They were long, black flies. In an editorial, in the London Daily Telegraph, August 21, it is said that this appearance of flies, at Havre, was a puzzle of the most mysterious kind. These flies had come down from a point over the English Channel. They had not come from England. I have searched widely in continental publications, and there is no findable record of any observation upon this vast swarm of flies, until it came down from the sky, over the English Channel. Pilot boats, returning to Havre, came in black with them. See the Journal de Debats, Paris, August 20, that they were exhausted flies, which fell, when touched, and could not move, when picked up. Or they may have been chilled into torpidity. Presumably there were survivors, but most of these helpless flies fell into the water, and the swarm, as a swarm, perished. If this is a puzzle of the most mysterious kind, I am going to be baffled for a description, as we go along. I don't know what comes after the superlative. 3 days later, another vast swarm of long, black flies appeared somewhere else. Just how much we're going to be puzzled by more than the most mysterious depends upon how far this other place was from Haver. See the New York Times, September 8, that, upon August 21, a cloud of long, black flies, occupying 20 minutes in passing, had appeared at East Pictou, Nova Scotia. Halifax Citizen, August 21, that they had passed Lismore, flying low, some of them appearing to fall into the water. Upon the 2nd of September, another swarm came down from the sky. It appeared suddenly, at one place, and there is no findable record that it was seen anywhere else, over land or water of this earth. It is told of, in the Entomologist's Monthly Magazine, November, 1880, off the coast of Norfolk, England, an avalanche that overwhelmed a schooner, millions and millions of flies. The sailors were forced to take shelter, and it was 5 hours before they could return to the decks. The air became clear, about 4 p.m., when the flies were thrown overboard by shovelfuls, and the remainder were washed off the decks by buckets of water and brooms. It was another appearance of exhausted, or torpid, flies.